Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
All right, and we are back with a new episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show. This is episode 11, and we have pretty much a living legend in the Chicago game scene.
please.
Josh Sway from President Rome Motor Games. It's nice to finally have you on the pod. We've been talking about this for months.
I know, so we've never been together. I'd seen one of the podcasts go up, and I said, wait a second, I think I was supposed to be on one of these. And it's such a long time ago that I actually thought that I had forgotten about it. So I was just like, oh my God, I didn't want to be a douchebag about it.
No, we're bad about our keys. Anyway, we're happy to have you on. You've been, how long has it been in the Chicago gaming scene for you?
I think it's like 22 years now.
Holy cow.
Like, I know, it's ridiculous. Like, I don't know how that happened.
So you're interesting because you knew Chicago like before Midway and when Midway is here, and then you're doing this separate thing like after Midway. So just the background, like how did you end up at Midway?
Yeah.
That's like the year zero of Chicago.
It is year zero. I always called that the Wild West days. So this was, holy smokes, like early 90s. I think I started in like 92 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was, it was basically the resurgence of arcade gaming and stuff, because it kind of, there was like arcade games of the 80s, and then that died, and then Nintendo popped up, and everyone was playing home games and such. And then for various reasons, the arcade started coming back again. And so I started at Midway around.
Because everything was extreme.
Exactly. Everything was extreme and stuff. And it was, like I'm a total arcade rat. Like ever since I was a kid, my brothers managed arcades and stuff. So I hated home games. Like I really hated because I thought they just sucked. They were underpowered. Arcades really sang to me. And so I started at Midway pretty much, like a year or two after I graduated from school. So the school that I graduated from was Columbia College here in Chicago.
Okay. Yeah.
I was studying film video. And a friend of mine got hired on at Midway about a year before I started, and they had just come off of the first Mortal Kombat, and it was just the big revolutionary thing was digitizing.
FMV.
Yeah, FMV stuff and digitizing actors and turning them into sprites. And so they, for the first Mortal Kombat, they were using like VHS tape to do this stuff. And in my last year in film school, I started getting more into digitizing. And so my friend got hired there. He saw what they were doing, and he remembered all the experiments that I was doing when I was in school. So he basically called me up and said, hey, you might be perfect for this because we're doing a lot of this video work. And I kind of got in by accident. I didn't necessarily want to get into games. I wanted to get into film, but obviously I had such a, arcade gamer background that it was just
skills just matched up, interest.
Exactly.
So
I thought I'd go in for a couple of years and try it out.
That's what everyone says, right?
I know. And then I just got sucked in and got into the culture. And it's like the Godfather. Just couldn't get out. Keep dragging me back in.
So maybe you can tell us a little about how Robo got started, because that's a different story. That's like post Midway.
I had done Midway. I had another studio after Midway called Studio Gigante. And then I was at EA Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was I was at EA Chicago for quite a few years. And then around 2008, there was, in the big corporate publishing world, there was just a lot of restructuring. Mm-hmm. And so EA basically was looking at all their studios worldwide. And obviously there was like the economy was starting to crash and everything.
Right, OA was kind of the slump.
Exactly. So EA kind of looked around and they basically had to cut costs. And EA Chicago was one of the studios that was probably one of their smaller studios, but at the same time was probably one of their, on a per person basis, was probably one of the more expensive studios.
Mm, yeah.
So they kind of looked at the studio. This is my guess. I don't have exact details on this. But basically what came down to was EA Chicago had a great franchise, which is Fight Night.
Yes.
And so we all worked on Fight Night Round 3. It's like one of the highlights of our careers. But then after that, they had Def Jam Icon, which did okay. But then what happened was we didn't have the Fight Night franchise anymore. That was given back to EA in Canada. And in exchange, we got the Marvel license at EA Chicago. Started working on that game. And basically what it came down to was, if you're an accountant looking at the numbers and you're seeing the studio that's kind of expensive and you're looking to cut costs and you notice that, hey, they don't have a franchise here in the studio,
yeah,
well, then you kind of put, you know, you match up the numbers like, all right, it looks like this might be the place.
Right, this
cut.
Is the consultant math. Right?
Exactly, exactly. And so basically that got closed down. And so when EA Chicago got closed down, I got contacted by some people that I know at Activision, and they were looking to do the opposite. They were looking to build up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they basically came to us, you know, and asked if we wanted to form a team here in Chicago to take on, you know, one of their projects. And, you know, I gathered the team that I was with at EA Chicago and just met up with them. And not that they signed us on the spot, but they pretty much basically said, all right, get your numbers together. Tell
mm-hmm.
us, you know, how much would it cost to prototype a game, how many months you need, what those costs are. And that basically will start up your company. So
nice.
That's how Robo basically got started.
And you've been rolling ever since.
Yeah, I've been rolling ever since. And it was just a whirlwind. You know, it was funny because EA Chicago pretty much closed around like November of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get RoboMode up by January 2009. So
holy
we had
cow.
3 months to do it. And everybody was about to go on holiday. And so we're trying to get paperwork
done. That's the worst time to try to get anything done.
It's the worst time. We thought there's no way they're gonna get us going on time, and everybody, you know, the team member, they're all interviewing at different studios.
Right.
They didn't know if this
they're
was
like,
gonna happen.
Should I move?
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So you know, yeah, and we told everyone, so you know what, go do whatever you need to do. Don't wait for us. But there's a good chance that this is gonna happen. And so you know, paperwork's going back and forth. But yeah, they like you know they came through. I mean, by January
mm-hmm.
we were ready for business.
So I mean that's awesome, and so it's. I don't know, it's a very, like, prototypical success story, right? But what do you think prepared you to do that kind of thing? Because that's a
yeah.
big jump, right?
Yeah.
You go from being an employee to running your own company inside this, like, six-month gap.
Yeah.
So we always like to, like, talk about the business
sure.
side of stuff. Like, was there anything like you did or prepared that kind of made you ready for that?
I think the thing that helped was that this is the second time we started up a studio. So
okay.
when I left Midway, me and three other guys, including the co-creator of Mortal Kombat, we left Midway in 99 to form Studio Gigante.
Okay.
So that uh-huh. was, if anything, that was when we were more inexperienced about starting a company. We're like, you know, four punks leaving a company.
Yeah.
With just like this, you know, blue sky
attitude.
We'll
make our own company.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like,
we don't
screw
need
the
you.
Man. Exactly. Yeah. We can do everything, you know. And so we went in. And so that was where, you know, like that's what I called, you know, the first pancake. You
yeah,
know
right.
what I mean? It's like the first
really
pancake.
Bad pancake.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that was where we made all of our, you know, initial mistakes. So we started up that company. You know, we had a great deal with Microsoft. Then we eventually did a game with THQ. But, you know, we learned a lot of lessons
mm-hmm.
from that company. So after that closed and the entire team went to EA Chicago, and then EA Chicago happened, when it came back again, it was kind of like, oh, I've seen this movie.
Right.
You've done
this
movie.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, you know, so we knew what to do, what not to do. That doesn't mean that we didn't make a lot of mistakes, but we didn't
mm-hmm.
make the same mistakes.
Yes,
so that,
right.
So that helped a lot. And, you know, one of the biggest things that I think helped with Robo was right when we got started, we were like super serious about making sure that it felt like a studio right off the
mm-hmm.
bat for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, a lot of the guys that were, you know, coming in to help start up the studio, they had never worked for a startup before. So,
okay.
so they'd uh-huh. been at EA for a really long time. So they were used to corporate life and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we did was, let's make sure we get an office space like as soon as possible. Even if it's a temp space, it has to feel real, because a lot of people are tempted to say, you know, oh, we'll get a team together, but we'll all work remotely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or what we're working out of somebody's apartment, which not saying it doesn't work, but the thing is that it, yeah, it
but
might.
But you guys had like a serious contract, right?
We had
so
a serious contract
yeah.
and stuff, and we need to show the publishers that we were serious because
yeah.
they were giving us
how
money.
How big
to
was the team you were looking
Oh, geez, man, we started off with like, you know, probably close to 30 people.
Yeah,
like, just
so
like that.
That's not
right?
an apartment size.
Yeah, exactly. but you'd be surprised how many people were saying that, you know, we should just keep the lean and mean. And it's like, absolutely not. You know? So
right, there's kind of a limit to lean and mean, right?
Exactly.
And then you're just being cheap at
exactly.
some
Exactly. So, yeah, so we got that going right away. And then the other thing that we did, and your mileage is going to vary on this, but we made, you know, like we had experience working with a company that takes care of all the benefits.
Oh, that, yeah, that's great.
Because it was super important. You're talking about a lot of senior people, and you know what? It's like they had just come out of, you know, a big corporate game company, and
mm-hmm.
so they're used to benefits, you know, 401ks, health insurance, dental, everything. And so, you know, to keep all these people around, we basically had to make sure that they didn't feel like they were going down in that respect.
Right.
So, yeah, it's something that not a lot of people think of right off the bat, but having that physical space and having some form of benefits just gave them some reassurance that, all right, everything, you know, there's a lot on the line here, so everyone,
mm-hmm.
you know, was serious about it.
And honestly, I feel for some people, the benefits are almost more important than the salary, right?
Yeah.
Because they want to know that their health and their loved ones are taken care of, and it goes a long way for the company to show that we really care about you as an employee.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's, you know, a lot of it is because we started off with so many senior people that we had to do that. Like,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have even done that if, you know, if we didn't have those benefits and stuff. And so, like I said, you know, if you're starting up a studio or just a group of people, and even, you know, they might be, you know, you might end up with some younger members who don't care about that stuff,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean you should skip it. You know, you should try as much as possible to do it, because, you know, if you want them to stay around longer, they're going to eventually grow into wanting that stuff.
That's true.
And it just makes everything, you know, like I said, you have more skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. We haven't talked to many people who've done companies that have hit the ground running as hard as you guys have. Because, like, most people that we've talked to anyway, they start with, like, a little homegrown project. There's, like, two or three people working on it. Maybe it grows. Maybe they add contract work. Maybe they, you know, maybe it stays the same size. Maybe it does the 37 signals thing and
mm-hmm.
just, like, stays 12 people or whatever max, but yeah, you had this, you know, you had the contract lined up, you had all these people lined up, so that's pretty atypical for the, you know,
people
that we've
but I do think that it's a common theme that you want to make your mistakes early regardless, right?
Yeah,
because we have a lot of people that come on and say, look, my first time I tried this, like, it was just a failure, right?
Yep.
The first pancake's always bad.
Yes.
But yours couldn't be, right? Because, like, you had this contract to do a thing. You had all these people that you were paying. So if your first game had tanked or, like, you know, you hadn't delivered on that, then it would have been
the thing.
Romoto.
No, definitely. I mean, there was a lot of pressure in the very beginning. And so when I say, you know, we avoided a lot of mistakes, because the second time we had a whole other round of mistakes that we went through. You know, it was rough, because we were putting a team together, forming a company, creating new tech, and working in a genre we had never worked in before. It was like a perfect storm of just craziness and stuff. And, like, you know, even the first game that we did, you know, in many ways that was a first,
what was the
pancake.
First game?
So the first game we did was Tony Hawk Ride, and critically we just got slaughtered on it. Commercially, it did extremely well, you know. So it's like this weird mixed emotion.
Did you use the hardware in house?
And we did the hardware in house.
That's crazy.
So I mean, it was like, without getting the detail, we weren't supposed to, and we ended up doing it all in house. And it was wild. I mean, you know, there's like in my office, there's this board over there that it was the very first prototype board, and it was basically a skate deck with. We soldered together
infrared
sensors, Wii controller, 360 controller, and PS3 controller, all doing different functions, and that's how we demoed the game to get the funding for the company.
Huh.
But we weren't supposed to do that, but we were like, again, we had a bit of that attitude of, you know, yeah, we can do this, no problem, you know. Maybe it's a Chicago idiot thing or something, but it's kind of like the whole attitude, we'll take it on, and then we did it, and, you know, it came out fine. But again, it was a first pancake thing, and, you know, just, it was almost like ignorance is bliss. We just felt like we could take on all these challenges at once. And when I look back on it, every time I talk about it and think about it, it's just like, holy smokes. Like, it was good to be an idiot, but that was, like, really crazy.
You know,
well,
I think to succeed in games, you have to be somewhat of a really big optimist, right?
Yeah.
The deck is always stacked
or
against
egotist.
You. Yeah.
You do. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, it's weird. It's like, I think there's a mix of it. Like, everybody has a bit of the imposter syndrome of, oh, you know, man, I'm in this. Like, I don't deserve to be doing this and things like that. And it's almost like, to counter it, you have to balance it with, you know, this crazy ego thing where it's like, yeah, I can do that, no problem. And there's nothing wrong with it. There are times where I run into a lot of people where they, you know, they don't have an ego, and I kind of,
mm-hmm.
and I look at it, I was like, man, look at the stuff you did. I kind of wish you would have an ego, you know?
Yeah, that, I mean, I think that kind of ambition helps, like, propel people to do big things,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. And the thing is that, you know, granted, you know, having an ego, it is surface value, but the thing is that people who work with you or who are around you, in many ways, they kind of want to see you have that confidence.
They're buoyed by it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly
and,
it.
And you also, like, paint yourself into a corner. Like, once you've made these promises, you kind of have to follow through.
Exactly.
Or you're done.
Yep. And that's the thing. It's, there's nothing wrong with making these big promises and stuff. And, it, you know, you're kind of putting your...
I mean, we don't hear the story of all the people who've made the promises and...
Well, Peter Molyneux is taking some heat right now, but
that's true. I'll leave that poor guy alone.
But no, I think if you're going to be the person that says, I'm going to be in charge of a game company, right?
Yeah.
And people are going to believe in this crazy dream of this game I'm going to make, you have to sell it not only to your audience and your team,
publishers.
But you have to sell it to yourself, right?
Yeah.
You have to be 100% convinced that you can pull off this crazy whatever you're going to pull off.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, it's like you're there to not only make your product or your company, you know, whatever it is, you're there to sell it. You're there to you know, make people want to buy it, you know, and unless you're doing some wacky free-to-play game or something. But like if you're doing, you know, a game that people are going to pay money for and you're walking around, you know, with displaying doubt about it, then who, you know, who's going to want to buy it and stuff? So yeah,
who's going to want to work on it?
Exactly. And that too. And so, you know, you're not just selling a game, you're really selling, you know, who made the game. And nowadays, you know, more than ever, you know, it's probably the cheapest form of marketing is putting yourself out there.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
and you know, and talking about it all the time.
Yeah, and it actually takes a while to kind of develop the voice of your company or your game, if you will. You have to practice it.
Yeah.
And I know when I started, I was really bad at it. And then, you know, a couple years down the line, you actually kind of get in a rhythm where you can kind of embody the soul of your company.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. And it just takes a lot of practice. And again, it's like, you know, it just depends on what the game is or how your personality is like. As long as you're authentic about it, people will figure it out.
It feels like there used to be very few people in your position of, like, sort of being the face of a game studio.
Yeah.
But now it's like thousands and thousands of people that are heads of game studios, you know, usually pretty tiny, but often like disproportionately influential.
Yeah, I think I actually wonder if it's you are right about that. I think the, you know, obviously I think with the ease of social media helps that quite a bit and stuff, because, you know, people can just find you, which is like kind of weird. But to go back to Midway Games, I think one of the things that that kind of has indirectly influenced me is, you know, when I was at Midway, I was working with like titans of the industry. And you got like, you know, guys like Ed Boon, John Tobias, you know, Mark Tamel, you know, Eugene Jarvis, and these guys were all in one building. And so they, you know, back then, even before social media, everyone knew who they were, but they were also just like the, you know, they're also basically the nicest people around. And so, and I think a lot of that has to do with just being in game development in general. And so, it's one of those things where when I, you know, coming out of there, I always felt like, you know what, you know, it's good to be open with people. It's good to help out people and stuff, because people will talk about it. We'll find out. But if you have a really shitty personality, people will find out about it more quickly now than ever before. And so, you know, I think being the face of a game studio, you know, it has a lot of responsibilities and yeah, it's nice to do. We kind of, you know, I kind of came into it kind of by accident. It just kind of happened. It wasn't something that, you know, I was looking to get into. But people need to take that seriously. And, you know, people are going to really hate your game if you're a shitty person online. how great it is.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the local, like, market for a bit.
Sure.
Because I published a piece a couple weeks ago that talked about, you know, why Chicago is a good place for like indie gamers.
Yeah.
I talked about how there was like this lack of big studios, and you pointed out that actually could be a detriment. And you know, I went back and thought about it. I was like, that does make sense. You know, a big studio is a good place. There are benefits there. So I'm kind of looking for your viewpoint. Like, why would it be good to have more big studios in Chicago? And then two, if I was someone coming out of school, what can I do to get myself hired by a big studio?
Yeah,
or a studio like Robo.
Sure. I mean, so like I have a, you know, in many ways, I have a very different viewpoint on things than a lot of people in this town, because obviously there's a big indie focus in this town now, which is great. But I actually feel that a lot of the focus on indie games here is because of the presence of, you know, publisher-owned studios here in town. At least there used to be, you know, more of them. So the way I look at it is that, you know, like I came out of, you know, at the time the biggest game publisher in Chicago, which was Midway Games. And at the time, Midway Games was probably one of the biggest publishers just in the industry, period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and I look at towns such as, you know, Vancouver and even Montreal, you know, a lot of very strong game development towns where there are big studios where, yeah, they're going to have, you know, they might have layoffs or they might have studio closure and things like that. But a lot of the people that come out of those studios, they end up forming their own groups. And they're very successful at it because they basically got their training at these big studios.
They made their mistakes on somebody else's side.
Exactly.
And
that's always been my thing. That's what I always tell people. It's like, you know what? If I came out of school, like a perfect example, my first job was at Midway Games coming out of school. I made so many mistakes there. I mean, I did a lot of things right, but I did... My first game, I just made stupid rookie mistakes, and everybody does those mistakes. But I got paid to do it, and then I learned from it, and I was able to iterate on it. And I see a lot of people coming into the game industry basically deciding, I'm going to go straight to doing my own thing. And I, you know, hey, more power to them. But, like, you know, you might be working part-time somewhere, and you're making your game, and you're going to, you know, absolutely guarantee you'll make your mistake on that first game. But the problem is that now, are you going to be able to survive long enough for your second game?
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting the second game is more important than doing the first game and stuff. And so, you know, I learned valuable lessons working at a studio. And I've worked at two publisher-owned studios, you know, Midway and EA. They both had their pluses and minuses, and I learned a lot of stuff from both of them that kind of helped formulate, you know, what I want to do with Robo.
Yes.
And so, you know, I just think that, you know, here in Chicago, you basically have, you know, two large studios, you know, and a lot of medium sized, and obviously a lot of smaller groups and everything. And moving forward on things, you know, I see
that's like Robo and Zynga.
So yeah, and so I mean, the biggest one is definitely NetherRealms and probably Wargaming.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have groups like us, Phosphor. I mean, Iron Galaxy is pretty large also right now. And all these other, you know, various places, but the thing is that there, you know, the thing about a large, you know, having, you know, if Disney was still around, and if there were, like, you know, they maybe if there was like a, let's say five or six good big size studios that people can, you know, can basically use as a training ground, that really in my opinion would make the indie scene a lot stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they get laid off from the place or they quit, they still come out of it with an incredible amount of experience.
Yeah.
And so my take has always been, you know, like I said, go make your mistakes on somebody else's dime, because then you'll have a very strong scene. Like, Los Angeles has a very strong indie scene out there, very experienced people, and they're doing very well. And I think Chicago, you know, potentially will have that. I think there's a good handful of people who are doing well, but it's still very young. And my fear is that a lot of people coming out of school will see that and say, I'm just going to go right into that route, and it's like, and not saying that they're, you know, that they're all going to fail at it. And so it's just that it's, I don't think they realize how hard it is.
Well, and we both come from the same background
where
we didn't start in indie, right?
Yep.
We worked other full-time jobs. I definitely learned a lot on my first 3-4 jobs.
Yep.
I mean, I'm still learning now. And it just makes it, as you said, it's easier.
Yeah.
Because you make all your mistakes there. You
mm-hmm.
learn all your best practices there. I mean, you also learn, like, what's good management practice, what's bad management practice.
Yeah.
And all that stuff just kind of funnels. I mean, building software is what we do at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
And whether you're building, you know, software for a web application or you're building a game, it's still a lot of the same processes.
Yeah.
So if someone's paying you to learn it somewhere else,
that's fantastic.
That's great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that a lot of people miss is, you know, it's, like, for us, you know, we're, like, let's say if we're recruiting for engineer, that we need somebody that's a seasoned engineer, it's, you know, it's hard to get people from other cities to come to Chicago, because they'll look at Chicago and say, all right, there's maybe three companies that I could work for if things don't go well here.
Yeah,
Whereas if they look at, you know, Vancouver or Los Angeles, they say, well, there's, like, you know, a gazillion companies, so I have some options if things just go completely to crap.
Yeah.
So, that's on the recruiting end of things for us, it's really tough to kind of grow, to grow more seasoned people around here.
Although you could push them on the cheap housing and the
you know what, it's weird. Like we, and that's what we do. Like, you know, we send them, you know, cost
you sell
a little bit.
Chicago.
Yeah, and it's like the weather. I don't care how you color, the weather sucks. You know, and it's like, and I've lived in Chicago for, you know, like 30 years now, and I still think it sucks in terms of the weather. And so trying to convince, you know, people to come from California to Chicago, it's like, forget it. It doesn't matter how cheap it costs.
So what do you think about trying to, like, just keep more talent from, you know, the schools around here, Chicago, Northwestern, Purdue, DePaul? Like, what can the industry do to kind of recruit better? Because, my class too, right? My class from Northwestern just scattered as soon as we graduated.
It's a catch-22 because a lot of people scattered because so this kind of goes back to your previous question is, you know, a lot of people will get into game development, they'll study it, and then they realize there aren't enough companies that are hiring around here.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of jobs around here is really low. So, so they're going to go to where the jobs
that's
are.
True.
And you can't blame them, you know. So that's the tough thing about it. I don't know, man. I really have an issue, and it might just be my mood in the last like year or so. But you know, I always tell people, it's like if they can't get a job in Chicago, they really should move out of Chicago if they really want to be in the game industry. No, seriously, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that I grew up in California, so I kind of know the lifestyle out there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, if you can't get a job in Chicago, you should move out because no one says that you can't come back again, you know?
Sure,
so like my thing is, you know, go where you can get the experience. You know, if it's here in town, fantastic. But if you have to leave and then you eventually want to come back, at least you have the experience. So when you come back, you know, you'll probably give yourself a very nice raise when you come back to Chicago.
That's
to work
true,
at a Chicago
yeah.
company. So I'm not, you know, like I always tell people, like, I'm not necessarily living in Chicago to make games. I'm living in Chicago because I like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the whole games, you know, games thing goes away, I'll probably still live in Chicago. I'll just go do something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Or
so,
you could go independent.
Or you go independent, though. But I'm not, it's like, I know this is kind of unusual for your podcast. I'm not the biggest fan of game development in Chicago from a business
mm-hmm.
point of view.
It's a fair argument. And again, like, I think a healthy ecosystem, right, does have kind of the big companies at the top.
Yeah.
What do you think would be like a roadmap to getting a healthier, like, big studio ecosystem here?
Boy. That's
It's complicated.
Right?
It is complicated. I mean,
asked you
about
a PowerPoint.
It's 45 minutes
long.
It's a combination of things. I think is just in general. Like I said, it's a catch-22 thing where there are not enough senior people who want to live in Chicago to get things going. So, you know, it's like when EA was here and was still going on and Midway still going on, they were competing with each other, getting people. That brought in an amazing amount of people in the city that, you know, that had experience already. So, you know, were making big games. Obviously, you know, that wasn't the... in many ways, some of the business models that they used, you know, were not the best. So obviously, they, you know, that collapsed. But you know, had those studios still, you know, if they were still here, including Disney and everything, then people, you know, in the schools locally here would want to stay in Chicago because they see that there's a lot of opportunities for work. And then people from California or wherever, they'll look at it and say, "Wow, there's some big name companies in here." So, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, yeah, we would totally move down here because we know our options. But like again, it's a catch-22 thing, and I in all honesty, I have no idea.
Do you think any of the smaller groups right now could either, you know, merge or kind of get big to the point where we can start bringing in more talent like that?
No, I think so too. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like a doom and gloom thing because something could happen that completely changes the game here in town that I can't predict. You know, that nobody can predict. You know, I would say that maybe a couple of studios like our size teams up with some other ones to help each other out and just organically gets larger just by merging together.
Right.
There are a lot of things like that. I would definitely say that, you know, on the indie end of things, if there were, a couple more breakout hits, like major hits happen, then that automatically is going to grow things.
Yeah.
You mm-hmm. know, I mean, right now there are a handful of hits, you know, here and there on the indie scene, but it's not. It's still early
Right, yeah, it's still like the first hit. There's no like continuity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So and it's not because like people aren't trying. It's just that it's still early. So
yeah, it takes time to make games.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you know what? What's gonna be interesting to see is in the next 5 years how the scene that I'm in and the indie scene and things like that and how that matures, because it might get to a point where a lot of the more successful indie people here in town, they grow to the point where they're not the exact same size as the publisher owned house, but getting close to that.
Yeah.
It just depends on how they want to grow their business. But once that starts leveling out, then I think you'll see a pretty big change here in this town.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of
grassroots
blueprint to look for.
Likely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. It's tough. It's just I think the thing that's helping is, the cost of making games is getting cheaper and cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to see a lot more stuff. So it's just, eventually there's going to be weeding out of people. There's just some people that are going to make, they'll make one, maybe two games, and then they just end up joining some group. On the selfish end of things, I would love to see that happen with some people, because then it's like, all right, cool, I can finally hire some people and stuff. And they already made their mistakes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like the ones that have some moderate success will probably become even more successful, and I think that'll grow things.
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about making games easier. Like there was someone at I think GDC that was ranting about middleware.
Yeah.
And I personally I love middleware.
Yeah.
Because it takes some of the tedium and just the time sinks on making games, because you can say, okay, I'll use middleware for the stuff I don't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when I was at Midway, everything was homegrown. I mean, because there was no middleware.
It didn't exist
at all.
Yeah.
And it was a pain in the ass. I mean, like, even like when we did Studio Gigante, we built our own engine, and also at EA, and I hated that, because it's like, from an engineering point of view, yeah, you get, you can make your hot rod car and make it exactly the way you want it, but from a designer point of view, it's like, that's fine. I'm glad it runs really well under the hood, but I still can't do this thing.
The difference between like an artist mindset and an engineer mindset.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's like...
Ultimately, we're making art, we're not.
Exactly. We're in the entertainment business,
right.
And so, if my business was, I want to make a game engine, I can understand that. But ultimately, the consumer doesn't care what the hell is going on under the hood. As long as my car gets from point A to point B and it's a nice ride, all that, it could be all spaghetti code for all I care. And so now it's kind of like a renaissance time, because there's so much tech out there that you can just kind of use and piece together. And again, it makes engineers cringe, but it doesn't matter. It's just like, these are the same people who eat McDonald's. Okay.
That's right. So
like McDonald's is a perfect example. Like McDonald's, like, yeah, it's a fine, tasty hamburger filet of fish, as long as you don't look under the hood and see what it's like. And so it's like this weird, conflict. It's like, yeah, you like all this other shitty stuff, but yet, you want to make sure your thing is finely tuned.
I mean, this couldn't be a Josh Sway podcast without talking about food at some point.
Yeah, I know. I knew it was going to come down to that. All my analogies are food and stuff. But
I was thinking about it. Like, cooking is actually a pretty interesting kind of maybe metaphor for building games, because cooking has artistic side and engineering side to it too, right? So you do want to make something that tastes great, that looks great, but you're also bound by, like, well, what ingredients do I have?
Yeah.
It's also pretty counterintuitive how you assess it. Like, as opposed to, like, as you're painting a painting, that you can kind of tell how well it's going. Whereas while you're making a meal, it's often pretty difficult to tell unless you taste it.
Yeah.
And sometimes get other people to taste it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of...
Definitely. I think a good analogy is, the most unhealthiest food is restaurant food. You can go to the best restaurant, and you're there for an experience. You're there for the flavor, for the taste, the environment, everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, chefs are trained to not care about nutrition. They will do anything. They'll put a pound of butter in something to make sure that it tastes right. You know what I mean?
They'll get good reviews.
It'll get good reviews. That's all they care about. And I think with games, it's like, ultimately, is it the best experience for the player?
Yeah,
and they don't, and it doesn't matter how you get there. It could be the biggest freaking mess and stuff.
As long as the player has fun playing it, and
that's,
it's a good experience.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't come from a programming background and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, coming from film video, my thing is always the, you know, in the end, is this enjoyable or not? I don't care what the hell led up to that. So I'd rather you not tell me.
Yeah.
You know, this hot dog's fantastic. Don't show me the factory.
So we usually do a segment called the What We're, just talking about what we've been doing. But since you're on, I think we do a special What We're where you just tell us your favorite restaurants.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Come on. Just off the top of your head.
Hot dogs is closed.
Yeah, hot dogs is closed.
Yeah, I was like, I mean, I don't know what my favorite is. I mean, it's like...
Oh, no, just give us your top, tell your head.
All right,
where
so,
you
what was I eating? So, the, so I had, I went to Ramen-san recently.
Okay.
So, for some ramen. So that was pretty damn good. They had a kimchi and fried chicken ramen.
Oh,
which sounded gimmicky to me,
uh-huh.
But it was like, I'll give it a try. And so anytime I go to a restaurant that I know is not owned by Asians and they have kimchi, I always know that they're going to fuck up the kimchi,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, you're always very... Like,
yeah, I want the straight-up pungent kimchi, and surprisingly they had that, so that was...
really?
That was excellent, and their lunch combo is excellent. I just had pizza at Daimo's in Wicker Park, so that was really good.
Mm.
But shockingly, you know, like, I actually don't go out to eat that often.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, even though it seems like I do and stuff, because having kids and everything, like I love cooking at home, so I usually cook as much as possible at home.
Okay,
and
mm-hmm.
It just seems like I go out to eat a lot.
Well, I mean, as you talked about building personality, your personality is food in Chicago, so
it's so weird. Like my Twitter feed is like half food, half
skateboarding.
Games.
And
I know. It's,
restaurant reviews.
I'm always concerned that I don't have a consistent personality online. So it's like,
makes sense to me.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. I think game people are really into food. You know, it's like, especially here in town in Chicago. There's like, I run into a lot of people, and not saying that their food tastes are great, but they whatever they like, they really get into it.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's Kevin Geisler of the Horses.
Oh God,
is a fast food connoisseur.
Yeah, yeah.
He reads like the blogs about it.
I'm sure he's gonna hear
this. Wendy's is better than this Wendy's.
I'm sure he's gonna hear this, but I'm pretty sure it, like, you know, his liver is like foie gras right now from all the fast food that he eats. But yeah, I did. It's funny, for some crazy reason, I think a lot of it has to do with Lent, I just got into eating filet of fishes again.
Okay.
So I can't remember the last time I ate it at McDonald's, but I know I haven't had a filet of fish in like 20 years. So the other day, like a week ago, I had one, and I was like, damn, it's actually pretty good. I was actually surprised by
That's the funny thing about McDonald's. When you don't have it for a while,
yeah.
and you go back and have it, it doesn't taste bad.
Exactly. So I started,
until the next day.
So I started eating it, and then next thing I know, I've had four of them in the last week. Because I love fried seafood. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And so my next experiment, I'm gonna try it, because fried seafood and kimchi is a great combo. So I'm going to, next one I'm going to get, I'm just going to get some kimchi and just, like, put it in the bun. See what happens.
Right on.
So we're wrapping up, but why don't you give us your info, just a Twitter handle and maybe a site for people to go if they want to check out your stuff?
Actually, I don't have a site. I mean, there's robomoto.com, which is a horribly outdated website that we're, like, just now updating. So don't
go there.
All
game makers' websites are terrible.
Ours is, like, really just, it's like the shoemaker's kids having no shoes.
Exactly,
like, our website's terrible. Twitter handle is Joshy TSUI, so JOSHYTSUI, and I think that's it. Like, my Facebook is private, so I don't share that with anybody.
Okay.
So.
All right, well, if people want to follow the food recommendations, follow Josh on
Twitter.
Just Google
Robomoto and Josh Sway.
Yeah, don't follow my Twitter for any game stuff, because I almost don't talk about games at all. So. But no, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks for coming.
Super fun. Thanks, guys.
Yep.
Appreciate it.
So it's con season, listeners. And just a reminder that you can get 15% off your first order with official CGS sponsor Inno Prints. Anything from t-shirts, business cards, flyers, whatever you need, they can do. They're local right in Chicago, so it's a quick turnaround and easy pickup. If you go to their site, that's inoprints.com. And enter the code CGS, you'll get 15% off your first purchase. And as a reminder, podcast listeners, we're getting toward the end of tax season. And if you still haven't gotten your taxes done yet, there's still time to get help from official CGS sponsor, Ledger General. Ledger General is a small accounting firm that specializes in little independent businesses just like yours. And if you give Marty a call and mention that you heard about him on this podcast, you'll get a free half-hour consult. Again, the website is www.ledgergeneral.com. So, as always, a big thanks to our sponsors, a big thanks to our guest, and a reminder that if you want to find us on Facebook or Twitter, you can follow us at CGSPod or search for the Chicago Gamepreneur Show on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.